Funding for THINK comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to THINK on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is it like to work for the company that gave the world the iPod, the iPad, and the iPhone? And is there something magic about the strategies that built Apple into such a heavy hitter, or could they be applied elsewhere with similar results? As senior editor-at-large for Fortune magazine, Adam Leshinsky covers both Silicon Valley and Wall Street, both environments where news about Apple can have major repercussions. And by talking at length to dozens of people who have worked at the company at different levels, Leshinsky was able to form a comprehensive understanding of what makes Apple so different from its competitors. He writes about it in his new book, Inside Apple, How America's Most Admired and Secretive Company Really Works. Adam, welcome to THINK.
Thank you very much for having me.
What's remarkable about your study of Apple is all the ways it manages to stay at the very top of the industry despite breaking pretty much every tried and true rule of business management.
Yes, and that is in the technology industry and outside of the technology industry. So to give you a few examples, the business world teaches leaders to be empowering and transparent. Apple micromanages, and it is opaque and secretive. The business world honors this notion of general management, where top business leaders should be able to play every position on the field, to mix metaphors. Apple is highly functionally organized. People have a function, and they do that function across the company. Managers do not have fiefdoms. They don't even have necessarily the responsibility for their own budget.
Yeah, the budget thing is really interesting because, in fact, Apple has said, don't worry about what this is costing. Give us the best product you can.
Yes, I liken this to the maxim that older people say to younger people, giving them career advice. They say, do what you love and the money will follow. Mm-hmm. Apple applies this in a corporate sense. Apple says, what products do we want to make? What do we want it to look like? How do we want it to work? How should customers use it? They ask all those questions first, and only much later do they say, what's the business opportunity here? How much should we charge? How much profit can we make? They think of money not only not second, but last.
Another thing that might come as a surprise to people is the contrast between the hip and fun image of its products and actually working for Apple.
Yeah. So Apple has given us all the sense through its advertising that it's this wonderful, whimsical place. In fact, that's the world that you live in. The Apple wants you to feel good about the world that you live in and to use its products to make you feel whimsical and hip and beautiful. Inside Apple, it couldn't be further from the truth. It is an authoritarian, highly secretive, highly focused, work-oriented environment, not a play-oriented environment. I asked people as I was working on the book and the magazine article in Fortune that preceded it, is Apple a fun place to work? And I would get these evasive answers. People would say, well, people have a sense of mission at Apple. And I would say, yes, but is it fun? And they'd say, well, people take great pride and accomplishment at Apple, knowing that their products are being used by everybody. And I would say, okay, I get it. So fun is not the point. And they'd say, that's right. You play at games and at outside of work for fun. At work, at Apple, you work.
I wonder if it's a little bit like working at Disneyland, where everyone else is having a great time, but if you work there, you've got your eye on the bottom line.
And in fact, Jobs took his notion of secrecy from Disney, where and clearly also this notion of the difference between almost the upstairs and the downstairs in the Magical Kingdom, mm-hmm. where the outside is what the world sees, and the inside is this highly efficient machine laboring very hard to make sure that those people on the outside are having fun.
So reporting this story had to have been a challenge given Apple's legendary emphasis on secrecy. How does the company keep even former employees so tight-lipped?
Well, it starts with asking them to sign non-disclosure agreements when they leave. Mm-hmm. But that's just the beginning. When Steve Jobs was alive, anybody at a formerly senior level would be justifiably concerned that if they were seen as divulging Apple secrets or being motor mouths once they had left the company, that their reputation would be tarnished and their opportunities for working with Apple at some point down the line would be harmed. Apple can be a very litigious company, and they take their intellectual property more seriously than anything else, and they're not above suing to stop somebody or threatening litigation to stop somebody from talking about their secrets.
So what did you do to get people to trust you?
Well, a few things. First of all, Apple people, both inside and outside, are very proud, justifiably proud of their accomplishments, and they want to tell the story of what they did at Apple and how Apple does what it does. The only entity that does not want this story told is the Apple Corp, you know, the corporate institutional attitude is that this is a topic that should be off limit.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I've spent several years writing about Apple, and when I did the first article, when I wrote my article in Fortune about how the company operates, I spoke to a great number of people, many of them who agreed to talk to me as long as I didn't identify them in any way. Once that article was published, people could see that I was fair to the company, that I wrote about it in a non-judgmental way. And so I was able to go back, first of all of those people, and then to many new people who were familiar with what I'd written in Fortune.
Tell us, Adam, about how Apple recruits talent and then decides exactly where to put the people they hire.
Well, Apple recruits, to make a generalization, Apple looks for the people who are the best in their field. They want people who are ambitious in the sense of want to achieve excellence and are willing to go deep. They also need, though, culturally, for people to be willing to be part of the team and to have their personality or their ego subsumed by the personality and the ego of Apple as a company. And that is no mean feat, and it'll be more difficult as time goes by, because for the last 15 years, you know, if you were a hotshot being hired at Apple, you knew that you were having your ego subsumed to Steve Jobs, one of the greatest entrepreneurs, you know, ever to live. And so I think that softened the blow for some of those people. As far as how they're assigned, I think you're referring to the fact that I write in the book that people are often assigned initially to dummy positions,
yeah,
meaning that they are not told exactly what it is that they're being hired to do. It is good enough that they're being hired to work at Apple. And they're told, well, you come on board, you start work, we'll introduce you to who your manager is. And once you've proven to us that you're trustworthy and that you're going to fit in, we'll let you know specifically what you're working on.
It's hard to imagine that these hotshots, as you mentioned, who are the best in their field that are being recruited, would be willing to take the deal. Is the compensation very good compared with other people that Apple would be in the same realm with?
No. Apple pays market salaries at best. I'm sure there are exceptions when they're looking for somebody who has extremely unique expertise, but money is not the issue. And obviously, you know, having a bunch of yucks at work is not the issue. The issue is that long before Apple became the runaway success that we know it to be today, this company with a $500 stock price and the most valuable company in the world, long before that, Apple was seen as a special place that created special products, that did things that no other company could do for a variety of reasons, starting with the leadership of Steve Jobs, but not only that. And so, you know, some will find that this is a stretch, but it's almost like a religious organization. And if you're a member of that religion, well, then there's only one institution that you would want to be a part of, and that's the church. And Apple has that feeling about it, that if you want to, in the technology or in the device industry, if you want to be a part of the company that makes the very best products in the world, well, then of course the only place you'd want to do that is Apple.
So if you quit to work for Sony or IBM or something, are you persona non grata?
At Apple?
Uh-huh.
Interestingly not. There's been quite a few instances of people leaving Apple and then returning for a second stint. And one of the reasons they return is that it turns out that they're not particularly well qualified to work other places because Apple is so different. But that's a generalization. For reasons that I can't necessarily explain, there's quite a bit of coming and going.
So tell us about the top 100 and what its members contribute to the company.
Sure. The top 100 is a group, a loosely organized group that Steve Jobs would designate, and he would refer to these people as the 100 or so people that he would want to put in the life raft with him if the good ship Apple were sinking. You can almost think of it as a Noah's Ark type of exercise in his brain. And these are the not necessarily the top 100 based on rank, but the 100 most important people in his opinion. And he would convene a meeting for the top 100 approximately once a year when he was healthy. They would go to an offsite. He would require that people be bused down from Cupertino, generally to a hotel in the Monterey Bay or Santa Cruz area in California. And he would then go over the product lineup for the next 18 months or so. And this would be the first time that this group below the level of the executive team, which is about 10 people, would be seeing a comprehensive look at where all the major products in the company were heading.
And being chosen for the top 100 this year doesn't necessarily mean you'll be back next year.
Correct, which is a, excuse me, a very Apple approach. There's no, pardon me, there's no sense of entitlement at Apple. You're not entitled to anything. Just because you had a good meeting with Steve Jobs today when he was alive doesn't mean that he's going to be high on you tomorrow. You're going to have to perform again tomorrow.
And so obviously that would create a situation where people are very much in competition with one another.
Well, I don't believe it or not, I don't necessarily get that sense, at least, again, not while he was running the company. People aren't necessarily in competition with each other so much as they are trying their darndest not to let each other down and to please him. Now, there is this long history of Apple teams competing against each other on the same product, but it wouldn't necessarily be a head-to-head competition so much as Jobs running this parallel exercise of having two different approaches to something and to see who would come up with the better solution.
And possibly taking something from each team?
Unlikely. Again, I'm generalizing, but not necessarily with the way Apple does things in that each team would be creating an integrated approach, and so Jobs would, you know, from a scientific or a technical perspective, these would be different approaches, and so he would choose the one that was better overall. Now, one area where there is brutal competition within Apple is for talent, and there's a caste system at Apple, and so the team that is perceived to have the hottest hand, that is working on the hottest product, and by the way, the definition of the hottest product at Apple was the one that Steve Jobs was the most interested in, they would have the ability to recruit anywhere in the company that they wanted. And there were quite a few hurt feelings when somebody from the hot group would go raid somebody from a weaker group.
Adam Leshinsky is my guest. He's senior editor-at-large for Fortune magazine and author of the new book Inside Apple, How America's Most Admired and Secretive Company Really Works. We'll resume our conversation in a moment. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Adam Leshinsky, senior editor-at-large for Fortune magazine and author of Inside Apple, How America's Most Admired and Secretive Company Really Works. If you'd like to join the conversation or ask a question, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Adam, how did Apple begin to conceive of itself as something beyond simply a company that made computers?
Well, in some ways, Apple always thought of itself as special, even from the late 1970s when it was founded. But as far as when it conceived of the notion of thinking beyond computers, this dates to the late 1990s, very early 2000s, when Steve Jobs first started talking about this digital hub strategy. And so you can think of the acquisition of the software that became the iTunes jukebox as being the first instance of this, because from iTunes software led to the iTunes store, which led to the iPod, and then Apple was off to the races as being about more than computers.
And there have been some missteps over time. Why is it that we all seem to forget about those and think of Apple as having only things that get hit out of the park?
That's right. So two reasons. One, the missteps have been relatively minor, and the successes have been extremely and truly spectacular. So, you know, a misstep would be something like the cube computer that they did, or Mobile Me, the email sync service, or Apple TV that just hasn't been that good. But those have been relatively small products, and they pale in comparison to the iPod, the iPhone, the iPad, the iMac, the MacBook Air, and so on. But another reason or explanation is that Apple's marketing is so amazingly good, and they are so successful at manipulating, and I say this in a sort of objective sense, at manipulating us to think about the things that they want us to think about. This is through traditional advertising, print, television, and also very clever product marketing that gets us focused on their new products.
The white headphones.
For example, that would be both a very fine product and a brilliant piece of marketing, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny because instantly, no matter what people had stuck in their pockets at the time that iPods became popular, you knew that was an iPod based on the color of the headphones.
That's right. And then the advertising that supported the iPod and the whole iPod lifestyle with those same iconic headphones coming down the lithe body of the silhouetted figure in the ads reinforced that image. It was enough that all of us went around cities or on buses or subways seeing, you know, hip young people with those earbuds sticking out of their ears. But then Apple would reinforce that in its advertising.
Yeah, we all wanted to be that cool.
Right.
So talk about Apple's dealings with other companies. For example, the music industry. Apple has become a tremendously powerful player in this industry, not always making friends necessarily with the people who want to sell their products on iTunes.
Yeah. So Apple had a vision that no other company had in the early 2000s, at a time when the music industry was besieged by piracy, and Apple created the first piece of software, iTunes, that would be a good and piracy-protected online retail store for buying music. Through sheer force of will and technical competence, and by the way, this was something that Steve Jobs did personally, he was able to convince the record label heads that they should work with Apple and that Apple was a Switzerland for them. Now, it was a very expensive Switzerland, and that they were turning over control of their customer relationship to Apple. But there was no alternative for them. The alternative at the time was being ripped off by Napster and the like. And so they went with it. So on the one hand, you hear the recorded music industry being embittered by the fact that it ceded so much control to Apple. But on the other hand, in a way, Apple saved their bacon.
Apple also is very, very particular about who sells their products and how they're presented in those retail outlets. And Best Buy is one example of that.
That's right. Apple has a love-hate relationship with its distributors, and they with Apple. So actually, Apple's own retail stores grew out of Apple's frustration with the way its products were being sold in retailers, including Best Buy. And Apple was innovative in terms of putting its own people in some of those stores. But anyway, the opportunity is so big for Apple that it can't sell all that it wants to sell through its stores or through its online store. And so it works with all of these distributors, including Best Buy and Walmart in the United States.
So let's go back to the corporate headquarters where things are being developed.
Yeah.
There may be teams simultaneously working on the same project who don't even know that someone else is developing the same product?
That may be the case, depending on the product, yes. And this is a result of Apple's internal secrecy that is really quite extraordinary. So every company keeps secrets, especially from competitors. It's also important in the consumer device business to keep secrets from your customers because you don't want them anticipating the next product too much because they won't buy the current product. But Apple keeps secrets from each other. And so if you and I work at the same, both work at Apple, but we work in different parts of the company, we are actively discouraged from talking to each other about our work. And this is so different from what would be the case at almost any other company, including in Silicon Valley, where at Google they explain away some of the free food by saying that they want people to meet in the cafeteria and talk about work so that they might learn something from each other about what the others are doing in the company. And that's just not the Apple way. One of the benefits of this, intended or unintended, is that there is not a lot of politicking at Apple. And I, at first when people told me that, I didn't believe them. But then I came to realize that if you don't have any information with which to play politics, you won't play politics, and instead you'll focus on your work.
You mentioned earlier that if there were these parallel teams working on a product, that Steve Jobs would choose the one that he liked best.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like a lot of major decisions get essentially made with due diligence, but quite quickly and always from the top down.
Yes, Apple is a top-down organization. Absolutely. It has a military-like structure, and the CEO is all powerful. Now, Apple people describe it as being collaborative, and I believe that, but it, just because it's collaborative does not make it consensual. It's not a consensus-oriented place. Jobs specifically made every important decision at the company, and people would praise him for making a clear decision even when they didn't agree with the decision. By the way, he would change his mind when he felt like it, but he did lead from a clear direction.
How common was a dressing down directly by Steve Jobs to someone who had messed up?
Extremely common. People at Apple, in describing the Apple culture, would refer to the hero bozo roller coaster. And if you interacted directly with Jobs, and there were many reasons why you might, even if you weren't a senior vice president in the company, you could go from being a hero to a bozo and back again over the course of the same meeting.
So was it not personal from his perspective?
It's hard to say, but I think the answer is no, it was not personal, but it's complicated because he held grudges and he formed opinions of people. And so while it's true that you could be a bozo and go back to being a hero, if you were a bozo too much, or if he felt that you didn't have the respect of your peers, someone could find themselves in the position of never recovering from their bozo status. And so I guess in that sense that it would be personal, and he would shun those people rather than necessarily fire them. And eventually, if you were shunned enough, you got the picture.
Hmm. Yeah, what's interesting about that is it almost sounds like a sort of corporate hazing. I wonder if, despite the fact that they were required to keep secrets from one another, being in that same boat allows employees to feel bonded to one another.
Well, I think people feel bonded to the people on their team, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people, the Silicon Valley is known for its social aspect. The engineers in particular like to socialize with other engineers. But Apple people, by and large, keep to themselves, and partly because they can't talk about what they're doing with anybody. I mean, they will literally just clam up if you even bring up the fact that they work at Apple. So yes, I think there is quite a bit of very constructive bonding within the tight confines of the team.
How does Apple set deadlines?
Apple plans everything out meticulously in advance. So Apple is like an orchestra with, it's like a symphony with different parts of the orchestra playing at different times and in different places, but with a clear determination of where they're going to end up. And so you can think of the beginning of this symphony as the first outlines of a new product, and you could think of the end of the symphony as the public keynote. These events at the Moscone Center in San Francisco, where all the camera crews are lined up, and we all know about them because we've seen them on television. Between those two events will be an elaborate, written down roadmap of the schedule of things that needs to happen from one point, from the beginning point to the end point, and that will include specific date deadlines. Now, those very well may change, but if they change, everyone who needs to know is aware of it. The date is changing.
And every deliverable has what's called a DRI, a directly responsible individual.
The DRI is part of the Apple culture. It is the person who is literally responsible for getting something done. And now that means you may attend a meeting where there will be a list of items on the agenda, and next to each item will be a name, and that's the DRI. And this lingo, by the way, predates Steve Jobs' return to the company in 1997. So it's part of how Apple works and has worked for quite a while. And what's so astounding about the DRI to me is that you'd think that every company would have a concept of a DRI. You'd think it would be the most brain-dead, obvious business concept, that someone should be responsible for getting everything done. And yet anybody who's worked at any company of almost any size knows that projects have multiple owners, and people have dotted line responsibilities where they're pointing in different directions as to who will be responsible. And Apple, for all of its size and its complexity, is a culture of accountability and responsibility.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, reading over those sections, it made me think about the number of meetings I have been to earlier in my career where you sit through a meeting and everyone agrees, that's a great idea, and then everybody gets up and walks away, and next week nothing has happened.
And that is not the Apple way. And so, again, when Jobs was alive, he set this tone from the top where he would have a product review meeting weekly. And this is radical, right? So many companies have quarterly product review meetings by senior management. And he would go over at these meetings every product that was currently under development that was important in his determination. And if he didn't get to it this week, he would get to it next week. And it would no more than 2 weeks would go by and before each major product was reviewed. And so there's a process at Apple where mid-level people are preparing their boss, who's preparing their boss, who's preparing their boss for this executive team product review meeting. And as you say, they would leave that meeting with clear direction on what needed to be accomplished by the next product review meeting, which wasn't going to be very far away.
Adam, what makes Apple so able to switch gears quickly when it becomes apparent that something is not working as intended?
Well, the pat answer to your question was Steve Jobs. Jobs would only pay attention to a handful of things at a time, and he had this executive management team that had been extremely loyal and extremely stable. To this day, everyone on the executive team at Apple, which is about 10 people, has been at the company at least since 2000. That's at least a 12-year tenure at the top. And so these people know each other very well. They meet face-to-face. It is not a teleconference culture, not a video conference culture. And so they're able to look each other in the eyes. They know what the problems are. And so when they need to make a shift, they just shift.
Mm-hmm. I think that face-to-face emphasis is very interesting, particularly given the industry. There are a lot of people who assume that if you are looking at a screen and talking to someone across it, it's not so different if one person's in Hong Kong and another person is in Silicon Valley.
Yeah, it's old school, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And that's you know, Apple in many ways, for all of its, for being at the cutting edge of consumer-oriented technology, it's very traditional in how it does business. You know, again, it's all these paradoxes. So they don't care about how you dress at Apple. It's, I've never seen richer people dressed as poorly as I have when you see senior Apple executives. But they do care about the quality of your ideas, and they do care about the factual nature of the data that you're bringing to discuss things. And so, yes, this it's you know, again, mind-blowing to me that the whole world, I think, natters on about the beauty of virtual telecommuting and virtual officing and nonsense like that, where this giant successful company says, no, we're going to attend a meeting in the same room with each other so that we can get the body language. And what Jobs would do, by the way, is he would have people attend these meetings, say somebody two or three levels down, and he wanted to expose them to something that was going on. He would have them sit in the room, and they would stay as long as he wanted them to stay. And then when he decided that they shouldn't be there anymore, he would tell them to leave. But this was his way of teaching. And you can't teach somebody who's on a video conference at 3 in the morning in Mumbai, for example, what you're trying to accomplish.
Adam Leshinsky is my guest. He's senior editor-at-large for Fortune magazine. We're talking this hour about his new book, Inside Apple, How America's Most Admired and Secretive Company Really Works. We'll come back to the conversation in a moment. If you've got a question about Apple or its culture or its successes, you can call it in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is senior editor-at-large for Fortune magazine, Adam Leshinsky. His new book is called Inside Apple, How America's Most Admired and Secretive Company Really Works. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. What you've described to us so far, Adam, sounds like an environment where you have a group of people who are very self-disciplined. They have a highly developed sense of business instincts with regard to what the market might want. It does not necessarily sound like a place that feels very creative. So how does Apple foster creativity, which is obviously critical in its employees?
Well, it's a great question, and it's one of the many paradoxes of Apple. It's most of its employees are not encouraged to be particularly creative. It being a top-down organization, they are mostly encouraged to do what they're told. However, they are talented, intelligent people with vast resources at their disposal. So when they have a task, they're encouraged to be creative in how they accomplish that task. So an example I could give you is that Apple has been very successful in its manufacturing and supply chain organizations, to the point where if it needs to create a certain type of surface on a product, it will find out the best kind of saw that needs to be used, and they will make sure that their supplier uses that saw. And this would be an arcane example, perhaps, of how that would not be a decision that would be made by Steve Jobs or Tim Cook or anybody particularly senior in the supply chain organization, but this would be the level of the type of thing that would be entrusted to somebody down the line. And so in that sense, it would be creative. Now, that's different from having the vision, say, to create the iPhone, but that's the way creativity works at Apple.
So we've talked so much about Steve Jobs this hour, and obviously he is not the only person, was not the only person running the company.
No.
But how able will Apple be to maintain the momentum it's built without him specifically at the helm when it seems to have been so much about his personality?
Yeah, so a few things. First, I believe Apple has been through a 15-year run that is, you know, the most phenomenal run in the history of the modern corporation, a 15-year run. And I think that had Jobs been alive and well today, that there's no way the next 15 years would have been like the last 15 years for Apple. Too big, too complex, too much competition, too much scrutiny. You know, we know more now about how Apple does what it does, and we can see Apple coming a little bit more than we could before. Having said that, the people who work for Jobs are outstanding individuals who have been schooled in his way of doing business for years now. It's a culture of excellence. And all the cultural things we've talked about so far, this accountability, responsibility, we didn't talk about design, but there's an emphasis on design over revenue optimization, for example. I think all of these things will remain at Apple without, you know, the great one. And the big unanswered question will be how well they'll be able to execute on strategy without this one superlative person. And I think that's what they'll be focused on, trying to figure out what their process is for having a strategy without this genius calling the shots. But they will still have all sorts of advantages over the competition. And in fact, one of my favorite quotes from the book is from a former senior software executive who said to me a few weeks before Jobs died, he said, when Steve is gone, the competition still won't have Steve Jobs.
We have an email here that asks, what's the story behind Steve Jobs' black turtleneck sweater, New Balance sneakers, and jeans at every press conference?
Not just every press conference, but every day for the last 10 or 12 years of his life. And, you know, he was quoted widely as having said that he had more important things to think about than his attire. I think it was bizarre. It was just one more aspect of his life that was just plain odd, because and for this reason, not because I think it's so terribly odd or eccentric to wear the same thing every day. I get that, but this was a man who cared deeply about design and aesthetic, and you would have thought would have been turned on by, you know, interesting clothing, but he wasn't.
There's been a lot of negative publicity of late regarding the manufacturing of Apple products in China. We have an email here from Brett in Fort Worth who asks, at what level of the company do you suspect the issues of irresponsible production practices in China would be discussed, the point during the meeting when the lower rank is asked to leave?
I'm sorry, just repeat the last bit.
He was asking, would it be the point during the meeting that the lower rank is asked to leave meeting?
Well, sure. I mean, first of all, I think that this is being discussed at the highest level of the company. We almost know for certain that Tim Cook, the current CEO, is personally involved and invested in this. I don't think that Apple believes that it has anything to hide about its labor practices. I don't think Apple believes that it's doing anything wrong. On the contrary, I think they think that they've done as they've done as much as they can, or they've tried as hard as they can, given the circumstances, to have as fair a situation as they can in China. And I know I'm using a lot of cautious hedge language, but I'm trying to portray how Apple thinks about this. Mm-hmm. So I don't think this would be an instance where they would, you know, excuse junior people from the room. If there's a junior person involved in their contract manufacturing in China, I think they absolutely would be part of the conversation.
So if they don't feel like they have anything to hide, do you sense, Adam, that Apple's action on these issues has to do mostly with their public image as opposed to concern for the welfare of their workers or contract workers at those manufacturing plants?
Well, it's complex. I think, excuse me, I think you know, these are Apple. The Apple executives are human beings, and I think they do care. There's instances to suggest that they're, you know, at the, I don't know, the more progressive end of the scale of caring about other human beings, and you know, in a very general sense. The fact that they've reacted the way they have shows that they're very concerned about their public image, and I discuss other instances in the book where they understand that bad publicity or that having a bad image is very bad for a product-oriented, consumer-oriented business. I think they feel, first of all, they feel picked on right now, which I find interesting and even a bit amusing. This gives you some insight into Apple's mentality. They are used to being the underdog because they were the underdog for a very long time. And I think it is an uncomfortable and unusual situation for them and their mentality to be the top dog. And so they feel persecuted, and that doesn't surprise me. It doesn't surprise me that the focus is on Apple because Apple's number one. It should be on the leader.
Talk about this. Is Apple's stock price appropriate at this moment, do you think?
You know, I'm a believer in that there's no point in debating a company's whether or not it's an appropriate level. It is what it is. By many metrics, Apple's stock price is relatively inexpensive relative to the profits that they produce and to their earnings and to the growth rate of their sales and earnings. What I can say with more authority is that I don't think that Apple senior management is the least bit interested in the topic of its stock price. They know they can't control it. They may even feel like it's going to be very difficult to grow their stock price because it's so high, but they don't care. It's not what they do.
What gets you fired at Apple besides leaking secrets?
Well, divulging confidential information will get you fired. And I think obviously incompetence will get you fired. It's not a culture that's quick to fire. It is a culture where people wash out quickly. So, you know, I can liken it to organ rejection. You know, the organ doesn't, the new organism doesn't, if it doesn't necessarily stick, you're going to find out fairly quickly that it doesn't stick.
In this top-down culture where decisions are made at the highest levels, what happens when a lower-ranking employee has a concern that perhaps a product isn't what it's supposed to be? Are people encouraged to make those understandings known?
The short answer is no. The longer answer is that employees certainly do have the opportunity to talk to their manager. But I'm making a generalization. This is a speak when spoken to type of culture. So at the very top, Jobs certainly would solicit his direct reports and people beneath them for their opinions on things. I don't want to suggest that there's no back and forth because there is. But I think it would be a report when asked and keep your trap shut when not asked.
So of the people you talked to, I know some of them had gone back and forth. Did most of them who had left the company still have very fond feelings about Apple?
Yes, that's an interesting aspect of people's relationship with the company. So overwhelmingly, people are fond of Apple. They're fond of their time at Apple. Even people who had difficult experiences and difficult exits are proud of what they accomplished and generally feel warmly for the company and its products. And among the senior ranks, I have more than once heard people suggest to me that there's a sense of abused spouse syndrome at Apple, and this referred not only to their dealings with the company but with Steve Jobs directly. They would be berated by him, and yet if you asked them how they felt about him, they would say that they loved and respected him and that they never had a finer career experience than when they worked for him.
So do you think that this corporate culture can be duplicated and applied successfully anywhere else besides Apple?
So, no, I don't think the culture can be, but I think that elements of the culture can be. So I think that there isn't a company in the world that couldn't do a better job of being clearer about its messaging the way Apple is so clear. I think every company could ask itself, have we said no often enough and in the right instances? The Apple culture is that it's more difficult to say no than it is to, or more important and more difficult to say no than it is to say yes.
Say no in that you decide what you're not going to waste time on, what you're not going to do.
Correct, exactly. Mm-hmm. We're not going to make this product. We're not going to go into that industry. We're not going to serve this industry segment. We're not going to put this feature on the product because adding this feature, even if it might be cool, might make the overall product harder to use. Even though people expect that feature, and you all, you know, everyone knows what we're talking about here. There's no USB on the iPad, and the iPhone didn't have a keyboard, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
I think every company could say, did we really ask hard enough whether or not this was a good idea, and was it that important? And then lastly, from a cultural perspective, what company couldn't benefit by figuring out how to have its people feel more accountable and more responsible for their actions?
Would you want to work there?
I would if what I did was valuable to Apple, and what I do is not valuable to Apple. They don't run a journalism organization. Someone asked me a slightly different question. I have a young daughter. How would I feel in 20 years' time if my daughter told me she were going to work at Apple? And I would say that if she was excited about wanting to accomplish something at this company, then I absolutely would support her working there.
Is it possible, and you sort of alluded to this earlier, that maybe the next 15 years, no matter what, couldn't be as much of a boom as the last 15? Is it possible for any company to be the coolest company for decades on end?
I think the short answer is no. Mm-hmm. In part, you know, cool by definition is an emotional, subjective concept.
Sure.
And you know, I would at the risk of not being sufficiently humble, I think books like mine will make it more difficult for Apple to be cool, because I'm, you know, it's like I'm the Toto and the Wizard of Oz pulling back the curtain. And this is an element of their coolness, is that they've been able to get us all to focus on these shiny products.
Did they try to pressure you at all not to write everything you wanted to write?
Not in the least. I mean, they almost couldn't have been less interested.
Adam Leshinsky is senior editor-at-large for Fortune magazine and author of the new book Inside Apple, How America's Most Admired and Secretive Company Really Works. Adam, it's been very interesting. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
It's been a great pleasure for me. Thank you.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions about the show to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.